Hello, Devlin here with you, and welcome to another edition of Devlin's Mondo Nostalgia Radio Show. And thank you for pressing play and joining me here tonight. I have a brand new episode here, and I'm looking forward to talking about a lot of things. I'm going to talk about some lighthearted stuff, and, well, sadly, I'm also going to talk about some sad news. A couple of deaths happened recently that kind of affected me in a big way, and I want to talk about them, but it's not necessarily going to be sad. It's more like a celebration of their life in many ways, and I'm going to do that in just a few minutes. I like to get that stuff out of the way. But first, I want to say that if you are watching this on YouTube, you probably have seen the new picture that we always try to, you know, post a picture to, you know, promote the episode. And yes, I am without hair. Actually, it's funny because this has only been a couple of days since I shaved my head bald, and I'm already getting some hair back. I can already, like, feel little fuzzies in, and I kind of knew that because my hair grows back pretty good. Wish it all grew back good because I do still have my little bald spot that I have, and that takes a lot longer to grow in. But anyhow, I wanted to just talk a little bit about it because I didn't think it would be take a significant amount of time, but I chose to do it because I didn't realize it, but when you go bald, it's funny how people react to you. You know, some people are just like, you know, why'd you do it? Like, what you'd almost think it was the end of the world. Now, in the last little while, I've been shaving my head very close. In fact, you know, I've been going closer and closer to my scalp, and a couple of months ago I asked the barber, I said, how close am I to going full bald? And he says, oh, you're actually only got two more settings on the razor. And so the game plan was I was going to just go down to the first level. And then around late spring, summer, when I needed to, you know, get my hair cut again, I was going to go all the way. And I don't know, something, I just got into the barber shop and it was early and I decided, you know, what the hell, let's just skip the second to last step and just cut it all off. And I made sure to get some pictures taken of it because this is the first time I had ever been bald. I don't even think I was bald as a baby. If I did, I think I actually had hair when I came out. So I have not ever been bald. You know, my parents sometimes when we were really young gave us brush cuts, but there was always some significant amount of hair. I've been planning to do this for a while. I don't know why. I don't have a reason. I never ever wanted to be bald. I always was like, oh, I hope I never go bald. I hope I never go bald. So it's kind of funny that here I am and giving it, you know, here's my hair. And I just decided that I wanted to go a little bit at a time, not because I was chicken, but because I always worry about my head shape. Some people actually shave their head bald and they look really good, and others don't because of their, you know, just the shapes of their heads. And I'm not trying to be cruel or anything. It just, sometimes I'm like, ooh, that doesn't look good at all. So I kept going closer and closer to the scalp, and then I realized, you know what? I think my head's okay for it. And actually, my barber was kind of nice about it, too, because he honestly didn't think I'd look good with it, even though he had been seeing it going down and down. But, you know, maybe he was just not trying to scare me away as a customer. But he's usually a pretty honest guy, and he said it actually looked really good going all the way bald. But as I said, now that I'm recording this, I'm actually not bald because I have a little bit of stubble coming in. And I don't know. I think I'm going to keep it around. But as I said, there was no real game plan. It's just, I just wanted to change. But it's funny how people react because they just assume, oh, there's got to be a big reason behind it, you know. And I would make jokes about it being like the beginning of my, you know, I want to become a supervillain. And I felt I needed to have the old Lex Luthor Kingpin look. But, you know, I don't know. I just was going through stuff and, you know, you all who've been, you know, sticking by me and listening to episodes know the last couple of months I've been really working hard trying to get my life together. And I'll be honest, I'm not going to talk about it and admit, but the last couple of weeks haven't been the best. So I just needed a big change. And to be honest with you, at my age, I'm not trying to say this to get pity. Maybe I am. Maybe I am. I won't lie. But the truth of the matter is that when you hit a certain age as a man, I remember reading somewhere that when a man turns something like 50 something, he disappears. And I've talked to some women, and they think that in some cases, they say it's even less for a woman. And I have a fear of just disappearing, like people just won't notice me or something. And I know that's ridiculous, you know, because I think I'm a bright personality. I sparkle, I shine, but I don't know, I fear it. And I don't think a bald head's gonna have. A lot of people didn't even say anything to me when they had it, like, you know, you wouldn't even know I had a haircut. Some people looked at me like something's different. Did you get new glasses or something? And then some people were just like outright. Most of it has been positive. You know, my nephew was, "Why'd you cut your hair?" And he tells me he likes it, but I don't know. I think I kind of shocked him, which surprises me a lot since I've cut it very close, so I don't see what the difference is. But oh well, I'm bald, and even though like I'm still kind of got like the curly stubble happening right now, it's gonna grow back. So I'm gonna decide whether I'm gonna stay bald. I might just do bald for a little while. You never know. Though that means I'm gonna have to get my hair cut a lot, and I don't know. I don't know if I want to spend that much money every couple of weeks just to keep it fresh. And I'm not gonna be one of those guys that are gonna be putting like, you know, doing it by hand with my razor or something like that, just because I don't know. That just seems like time consuming, and I can barely find time to do podcasts, let alone do that. And I can multitask. I'm actually just doing my fingernails right now. And but I don't think, you know, using a razor in podcasting is a smart idea. So I've chosen not to do that. Anyhow, my first real topic today is there's been a lot of celebrity deaths happening lately. And I hate that because I haven't been steady with my podcast. It seems every time I come in to do a podcast, the first thing to talk about is, you know, people who have died. And that's why I got to keep getting back to doing regular podcasts so I don't just look like Manu Nostalgia is all about death. So, but there were two significant deaths that affected me in a big way. They were part of my childhood growing up, and not even my childhood, a little bit older than childhood. Well, one. But I wanted to talk about them because I'm sure other people have been affected with them too. The first one was Luke Perry. This affected me for a lot of reasons. I'm a big fan of Luke Perry. I don't know if I've ever admitted this, but I used to be a huge Beverly Hills 90210 fan. And I watched it regularly and every week. And I don't think I watched the whole season. I think I left about two seasons near the finish because. And it was actually Luke Perry that got me to stop watching, which is sad, because when he returned, because for those of you who remember, he actually left the show and he came back. And when he did, I really didn't like the character direction they went with him. Had nothing to do with Luke Perry. He was actually a pretty awesome actor. I didn't know much about Luke Perry when the show started. Beverly Hills 90210 was a huge part of my upbringing, and I was in my 20s when it came out, and I loved watching the adventures of Brenda and Brandon as they moved from Minnesota to Beverly Hills, and I was tuned in every week and loved all the storylines they did. And people forget that Beverly Hills 90210 was a pretty groundbreaking show because there had not been a lot of hour-long dramas that were focused primarily on teenagers. Now, there was stuff like in Canada, we had Degrassi Junior High and stuff like that, which dealt with serious issues and that. But Beverly Hills 90210, you know, was one of the first ones that really dealt with serious issues and stuff. Now, again, Degrassi did it. Saved by the Bell might have already been around already at that time, but they only dealt with serious things once in a blue moon. But Beverly Hills 90210 was just an incredible cast, and after the pilot episode, they knew instantly there was something missing from the canvas. And for those of you who don't remember, Luke Perry wasn't on the show right at the beginning. He actually comes in around episode two. I think they had a pilot movie and immediately needed a bad boy. And so they brought surfer dude Dylan McKay in, and he was going to cause havoc with all the girls on the screen, especially Brenda and Kelly, who he'd have on and off again relationships with, and of course he'd become big friends with Brandon Walsh too. As you can see, I'm a big fan. And when they originally decided to write off Luke Perry, he decided he wanted to go on to other things. He had done some small roles in some movies. He did movies like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. A lot of people forget he was the male lead in Buffy the Vampire Slayer opposite Christy Swanson. And I never got into Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I actually loved the movie. And I don't know, because it was just a goofy comedy, I think I liked it. And when I watched a couple episodes of Buffy, and I didn't hate the show, but it was just not my, cup of tea. And I always joke that, the movie was far superior than the TV show, but I usually just say that to drive Buffy fans. He also did some movies like 8 Seconds, and he had a small part in The Fifth Element. I believe that's the right movie. Might be Stargate, but I'm pretty sure it was The Fifth Element. And he decided he wanted to try some new things. When they actually wrote off Dylan in the first time he left, I thought it was one of the most amazing storylines they had ever done, because they had established Dylan's dad as a gangster, and when his dad died, I should say spoilers, but if you haven't watched Beverly Hills in the last several decades, you probably won't watch it now. But who knows? Maybe I know some people are rewatching it and stuff. But anyhow, he wanted revenge on the person who was responsible for his father's death. So his game plan was to befriend the guy who did it, his son named Tony. But Dylan quickly found out that Tony was a girl, and instead he decided to have a romance with her. And it was true Shakespearean. He actually wound up falling in love with this girl and decided that the revenge wasn't important because he was in love with this girl and he couldn't kill the girl's father. And that wasn't stopping him from the gangster trying to go after Dylan. And in one of the best Shakespearean, like, kind of twists, I remember the absolute episode when I watched it was that after they got married, they were basically going to assassinate Dylan. And his wife Toni wound up in Dylan's car, and she was heading out, and the gangsters were all set up to make the hit, and the car was just riddled with bullets, and Dylan and Brandon were running up with their cars, and then the father realized that it was actually his daughter in the car, and they didn't kill Dylan, they actually killed his daughter. It was powerful. It was so Shakespearean, and it took Beverly Hills into a thing where they were just like, we're gonna do this kind of edgy kind of storyline. And I remember that it was just so incredible. And Bad Boy Dylan was written off, and then he came back a couple years later when Jason Priestley left, and I guess they got him back, offered him a lot of money to come back because they wanted another strong lead in there, because Jason Priestley was holding down the fort. And when he came back on, Dylan was very different, and I wasn't a big fan. But I'm rewatching it now with Mike, my partner, and I'm gonna watch right to the end. So even those seasons that were making me cringe, I honestly think Beverly Hills is one of those shows that ran way too long. I always thought the show was about Brandon and Brendan Walsh, and once they were gone, I don't know why the show continued. I know the name is still the area code, or what do you want to call it, but I still think the show's heart was gone, and it should have just ended. Anyhow, Luke Perry was a major heartthrob on the show. I loved it because both him and Jason Priestley were like everybody on the cast was like treated like superstars, but they were like the hot guys that you wanted to be, you know, you wanted to either be or date or, you know, whatever, you know, be friends with even. And I love that, you know, you had nice guy Brandon and you had a little bit of a wild child Dylan. And it was a great thing. And Luke Perry played the part awesomely. He had a James Dean kind of feel. He was skinny and lanky, so he wasn't like one of these muscular buff guys that they would get now if they casted a soap. You know, he had nice muscle tone, but he wasn't like this thing. He was just like a surfer boy that you just wanted to like. And I loved it because they always made him vulnerable and stuff. Now, they gave him some stupid storylines around the way, but he definitely, you know, he brought his A game, even if the storylines didn't call for it. He had some really strange things, but I won't go into that now. Then he, you know, he did a lot of TV movies. He did a couple of movies. I know he did a series of Westerns, I believe. He tried his hand at a couple things just to try to get past that Dylan McKay. And I think he kind of did it. He starred in some shows. He took some edgier chances, like shows like Oz. And I want to say there was another one he did. I want to say it was called Jericho, but I could be wrong on that. And, of course, most recently he had joined the cast of Riverdale, which was kind of incredible when he did, because what I loved about it was I grew up with Beverly Hills 90210, and then I started watching Riverdale. But Dylan went from the bad boy on that show, the bad teen, to the dad of the head character. He played Archie's father. And it was weird for me to watch, you know, suddenly Luke Perry was the dad. And not only did it make me feel old, but it was, but you know, he's great on it too. And when they cast his ex-wife on the show as Molly Ringwald, it was almost like, wow, this is like 80s and 90s meshing to like the perfect, like retro couple. And although I didn't see the chemistry between them. So I almost said, yeah, I can see these two divorcing just because I don't see the chemistry. But anyhow, I was a big Luke Perry fan. And then, of course, a couple weeks ago, he had a stroke. And a lot of people were in shock. And the more we were reading about it, the more it looked like it was more and more serious. And then I remember just one day hearing that Luke Perry had died, and he is only a year older than me at 52. And it was mind-blowing because, you know, they had to stop production on Riverdale. They had just talked about doing a revamp of Beverly Hills 90210, where all the original cast were going to come back. And it looked like it was a really weird concept for a show, because it was going to be not necessarily them coming back as the characters, because they kind of did that when they redid Beverly Hills with the show 90210, but they were going to do it kind of like a mock way. And I keep saying that they were going to do it, but they might still do it. But everybody had signed on. The only two that hadn't were Shannon Doherty, who had a lot of medical issues. She's been dealing with cancer and stuff. And Luke Perry, who was on Riverdale. But both of them had seemed interested in coming on, and when they said that they were going to revamp this show, that both were going to be welcome. And Luke Perry had stated he definitely wanted to come on the show. He had other commitments. So it's really sad that if they do this Beverly Hills 90210 thing, that he will not be part of it. I don't know if they'll recast or just write Dylan off. I don't know how they would deal with it. Dylan is such a big part of Beverly Hills 90210. It would be hard not. Even if he wasn't going to be on the show initially, he did say he wanted to do guest appearances, but now that he's not even there. But anyhow, it's a weird concept. It wasn't just going to be them playing the characters from Beverly Hills 90210. It's them playing the actors who play the characters, getting ready to deal with doing a reboot. So it was kind of like a surreal soap, but they were going to make it over the top and crazy, but they would actually be playing versions of like Jenny Garth and Jason Priestley and, you know, Gabrielle Katiris and Ian Ziering and David Austin Green and Tori Spelling, and so a really interesting concept, but it's just sad that if it does come to play, it's going to be missing a huge element. And for those of you who are big Beverly Hills fan, as much as I know there's a fan base for Dylan and Kelly, for me, it was Brenda and Dylan forever. Brendan and Dylan forever. They were the ones I absolutely always cheered for. And when Shannon Doherty left the show, I was like, oh no. But I didn't hate him with Kelly. I just thought Kelly was better with Brandon. Anyhow, that's my talk about Luke Perry, part of my childhood dying. I still, sometimes when big celebrities die, you're mind blown because it takes you a minute, If I see an old repeat of 90210, or if I watch Riverdale and he's still on it, I'm just like, I have to take a moment and say, no, he's gone. And that's mind blowing. I do want to talk about another death that happened also recently. Peter Tork of the Monkees. I was a huge Monkees fan. Now, before you people think I'm really old, the Monkees were not my generation. For those of you who need an update, the Monkees were a group that were manufactured in the 60s. When I say manufactured, they put a casting call out because they wanted to do a TV show kind of based on the Beatles. The Beatles had released movies like Hard Day's Night and Help, and they wanted to do a show about four musicians that got into kooky adventures and stuff. And of course, they cast, Mike Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz, Davy Jones, and Peter Tork. Now, this was all in the 60s. Now, they actually sang and eventually learned how to play music. Mike Nesmith and Peter Tork actually were musicians. Mickey Dolenz did play the drums a little bit, but they actually, when they started, they weren't all that great. I think Mike Nesmith and Peter Tork did know the guitar a lot, but not to the point that they were playing on their own albums at the beginning. They were just going to be eye candy and, goofy humor. And it worked. Not only did it work as in the show was a big success, but the albums and the music they created were huge with, hits like Last Train to Clarksville and I'm a Believer, Daydream Believer, just Pleasant Valley Sunday, just so many great hits that were huge. In fact, on Billboard, they actually were, when they first came out, they were just as successful as the Beatles when they came out because their albums were hitting big, everything was huge. They only had a smaller stay, but in some ways, they stuck around for a long time. Now, when I said this is not my generation, but they are part of my childhood. In the 80s, to celebrate, I think it was like their 20th anniversary or 25th, they actually started reshowing the old Monkees series in the States. They did it on MTV. Here, they did it in our own Canada's Much Music. And I started watching the Monkees, and their greatest hits albums was released. They had another single on the chart. That was Then, This Was Now. Some of you may remember that one. And that actually became a top 40 hit for them. And Monkee Mania was again big. People are going out buying the old albums, listening to it. I remember they re-released Daydream Believer, and they'd even play that video a lot on the video stations and stuff. And so I became a huge fan of the Monkees. Now, we had already lost our first Monkee a couple of years ago, and it's always sad when a favorite group of yours, you're never sure who the first person is to die. Like Mike and I grew up on the Brady Bunch, and we always say it's going to be weird when the first Brady kid passes away. We've lost both parents now and Alice, but one of the kids, that'll be huge. Like, we've already lost two of the Partridge family, but we haven't lost any of the Brady kids. So I remember when Davy Jones died, it was shocking to me because we had not lost, we had lost two Beatles already, but we hadn't lost any of the Monkees. And it was Davy Jones. And to be honest with you, he was probably the one I I didn't expect to die. It was really shocking. But when I got the news that Peter Tork died, I was shocked because I had crushes on the monkeys. And it's weird because every time I watched the monkeys, it seemed like I'd go through phases of who I had a crush on. And unlike any other band, I had a crush on every member of that band at one point. One time it was Davey. One time it was all about Mike. I liked his, quirkiness and thing. Mickey Dolenz is probably my favorite when I look at the past episodes. But there was a short time that I had a major crush on Peter Tork. He was the goofy one on the show. Like, they were all goofy, but he was really goofy. But there was a sweetness about him too that was just like you just wanted to kind of cuddle him as well as, just laugh and joke with him. And he didn't do a lot of the music. In fact, a lot of them did singing, like Davy Jones did a lot of the singing. Mickey Dolenz did a lot of the singing. Mike Nesmith sang on a couple of tracks that, quite a few tracks, but they were never really released as singles. And Peter Tork did some music, vocals, but not as much as the others. In fact, I found out recently, not when he died or anything, a couple of years ago, that he actually is the lead vocal on a great song called Your Auntie Griselda, which is just a goofy song that if you're a Monkees fan, you're probably getting that in your head right now. I always thought that was a Mickey Dolenz type song, and I found out that it was actually Peter Tork, and I actually can hear it now. And when they did reunion shows, he used to sing that because that was one of the few songs that he sang. He also sings with Davy Jones on Shades of Grey, where they sing, Davy sings half the song and he sings the other half. But you really have to look to hear Peter Tork songs. But you know what? It was an incredible thing for the Monkees, and Peter was always up for reunions and stuff like that. Most of the times it was the reunions were Mickey, Davey, and Peter, but it took them a lot. Mike Nesmith always kind of he'd show up for the odd show and stuff, but he really was kind of like he was proud of his monkey stuff, but he was just wanted to do his own thing, and so he never came out for a lot of the reunions. Which is sad because there's only a couple times that the Monkees ever reteamed again. Even when they had their resurgence in the 80s with the song This Is Then, This Is Now, I believe in the video it's only Peter and Mickey that show up for it. And I don't even know if Peter plays on that song. I think he just showed up in the video, but I'm not sure. But anyhow, the group still stays loved, and they only had a couple of years of success, and they had a lot to do with the downfall of their success too. I've watched a lot of specials and documentaries, and even they had a TV movie called Daydream Believer, The Untold Stories of the Monkees, and they only ran the show for 2 years, and after the first year the show was so loved, but the Monkees kind of were even though they were one of the biggest groups on the planet, they didn't feel they were getting respect from their peers. And they wanted people to know that they could do more serious music and that they could play their own instruments. And they also wanted the show to be more cerebral. It was the first season's very goofy and corny. And the second season, they still have that, but there are episodes where you can tell the Monkees tried to take the reign. They even got rid of the soundtrack and stuff, the laugh track, sorry, and tried to do like more over the top kind of thing. And people didn't like it, and the ratings just fell immediately, and they were canceled. But they still kept releasing albums. But again, they tried to go more psychedelic and tried to go in places like where the Beatles went, where they were kind of poppy at first, and then they went into more, instrumental. They also did a movie. I got to do a shout out to the movie Head. This is a really surreal movie that. If you ever are in the mood, I've actually, you can find the movie on YouTube, and I've actually shared it on the actual Facebook Mana Nostalgia page. A little shout out for that. Go check it out. There's lots of good stuff added every day. Anyhow, and the movie Head was, they wanted to take it over and show a real different side. It was co-written by Jack Nicholson, but this movie is just so out there and surreal. It's not overly good. And you really, I could tell that they really were hoping people were on smoking pot or doing acid or LSD or whatever to watch it. But it doesn't really translate as a movie where the Beatles tried to do kind of that psychedelic stuff with Magical Mystery Tour and stuff. Even that seems coherent compared to the Monkey's Head, which is just a bunch of skits that don't work. And even the music in it, there's some really good stuff in there, but it's so un-Monkees-like. One of my favorite Monkees stories was that they actually did a special, and the network they were part of agreed to do the special. And they decided again that they wanted to do it more trippy and head-like. And when the network saw it, they were just saying, well, this is crap. We wanted it more like your old TV series. And they're like, no, we don't do that anymore. So they decided that they were going to show it, but they put it opposite the Academy Awards, which was almost like absolutely killer, because the Academy Awards at that time were like, that was the ratings getter. So anything up against it didn't have a shot in hell. So they decided to just throw it there. But to put salt in the wound, apparently they showed the first part at the end and the second part because they couldn't make sense of the story, and they actually showed it. And so people thought it was even more crazy and fucked up. I forgot. I want to say it's called Monkeys 33 and a Third, but I could be wrong. But it's out there, and if you get a chance to see it, definitely check it out because it is so unbelievable. But I still like watching the old Monkees episodes, and I definitely still listen to the music. And I even like some of their quirkier music that wasn't top 40 friendly. And Peter Tork was just, he added so much to the show. He was the goofy one, but he was also kind of the quiet one. And you could tell there were times where he was just like, I think there was a deepness about him that, he was okay playing the fool, but I think he kind of wanted people to see that deeper side to him. I don't know my monkey lore too much, but I think he was one of the first to actually leave the group because he really just didn't want to be part of that brand anymore. But he eventually embraced it and would go on tour with them because he was honored to be a monkey, realized that that was a part of him, and that's who he was. And I was so sad when he died, and now we have got two monkeys. We have two Beatles dead and two monkeys. And, it's really sad. And I hope I didn't play this as sad because I wanted to pay tribute to the wonderful men these guys were, because they did play a big part of my upbringing. I loved the resurgence of the Monkees. And if you are a big Monkees fan, or maybe you don't know about this, but I think it was last year or the year before, they actually released a brand new album of new material. And all four Monkees played on the album. Okay, Davey was already dead, but they actually used some of his old vocals to get in there. And they released a couple of videos, You Bring the Summer, and I can't remember the name of the other one, but it's actually great music. It was actually helped out with Jack White of the White Stripes. I might be getting that wrong because I'm not hip with the music, but it's an actual surprisingly good album. And check it out. There's like You Bring the Summer, and there was another song that was actually She Makes Me Laugh, I think it is. You Bring the Summer and She Makes Me Laugh. And check those songs out. They're on YouTube. And definitely pick them up and, whatever site you buy your music from, check it out because it's actually really good. And it's sad that, Top 40 radio isn't as mixed and diversive as it used to be, where we used to play a little bit of everything. Because I remember growing up, my radio station used to love groups that were making comebacks. And, I definitely played it a lot. So check it out. So anyhow, nice tribute there to Luke Perry and Peter Tork. I know there were some other people that passed away that were pretty big, but those two really affected me. And I promise I'm going to try to do more podcasts so it doesn't sound like every time I come back, it's somebody died. Anyhow, I'm going to talk about something really fun in the next half, and definitely something that follows Mondo Nostalgia. I got a chance to check out The Room at the Playhouse Theater, and one of the stars, Greg Sestero. I'm going to get this wrong. But anyhow, I'm going to talk to you about my love of what is considered to be one of the worst movies of all time, The Room, and I'm going to tell you about the great time I had when I recently saw it. With Greg Sestero in the audience and doing a Q&A, and I got a chance to like take a picture with him. And I'll tell you all about that and more when I'm back right after this break.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with a parade of items to tempt your taste. Buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs, cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream treats and other good things to eat, plus ice cold Coca-Cola. So bright, so bracing with a taste and tingle all its own. Pause and refresh with a Coke at our snack stand right now.
Hello, welcome back to Devlin's Mondo Nostalgia Radio Show. Hopefully you grabbed yourself a drink, maybe a little snack. And thank you for joining me for the second half. And I'm going to talk about something, a real love, passion of mine. A movie that's been dubbed one of the worst movies of all time, The Room. This is a 2003 film. It's a romantic drama that was directed, written, and stars a man named Tommy Wiseau. And this movie, when it first came out, they put it in one theater and it didn't do very well. And he actually financed a lot of this movie on his own, and he actually produced it and promoted it on his own. And this movie became notorious because even though it was playing in one theater and nobody was going to see it, suddenly it had a cult following. Yeah, a whole bunch of Hollywood's finest, people like Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel and Kristen Bell started discovering this room and saying, you got to come check this out. Now, they weren't saying it because it was a good film. They were saying it because this is a really, really bad film. The first time I heard about The Room was actually in a magazine, Entertainment Weekly, I used to get regularly. And they used to do cult movies, and they said that this movie was fast becoming a cult because after its initial release, where it flopped, it started playing in midnight showings, and people started yelling at the screen, similar to like a Rocky Horror Picture Show, and throwing spoons. And we'll get to the spoons in a bit, but basically the movie went from being a movie that looked like it was never going to be seen by anyone to becoming one of the biggest cult classics of all time. And I can tell you from experience, this movie is growing in popularity. Even though it's a hard movie to find, I don't even think you can buy this one on DVD yet. Maybe they're holding off because of the things. I got to see mine through YouTube. Somebody had posted it there and I got a chance to check it out. And it lived up to everything I heard about it because people just kept telling me, you know, how awful this movie was. And but one of those, it's so bad, it's good. And I consider myself a connoisseur of crap films. You know, I love movies like Showgirls and Plan 9 from Outer Space. So anything that would come close to that, but The Room certainly does. And one of the main reasons is its star, Tommy Wiseau. Now, this movie is still pretty big. Last year I got to see it at the Zoetic Theater where they showed it, and it had a full house there. And again, everybody was screaming at the screen, throwing spoons. Okay, the thing with the spoons is that there's not a lot of locations in this movie. Basically, the room is this living room. And for some strange reason, there's a framed picture of a spoon on the table that gets seen quite a lot. And whenever it's seen, it gets plastic spoons thrown at. And you really don't realize how much plastic spoons are in it until you actually go to a live showing of this and see it showered in plastic spoons. Now, I saw it last year at the Zoetic, But just recently, I got to go see it at the reopened Playhouse Theater, which I probably will do talk about later. This was a theater that I knew growing up. In the 1970s, it played. But when I went to all the movie houses that I could, and I went to every one that Hamilton and the Hamilton area had, but I couldn't go to the Playhouse because it was a porno house when I was a kid. So I didn't get to go into this theater. So when it was recently announced that they were refurbishing it to be a theater again, I couldn't wait to go into this theater. And the room just seemed like a perfect movie to go see for the first time. The Playhouse is absolutely gorgeous, but I won't go into that right now because I'm here to talk about my love of The Room. Now, is it as bad as people say? Yes, it is, and it's brilliantly bad. You may have heard of The Room a couple of years ago because the co-star in this movie is a young man named Greg Sestero, and he actually wrote a book about his experience filming this movie. And it was called The Disaster Artist, which eventually was taken by James Franco and made into a movie that actually got some Oscar nominations to it. And suddenly, this bad movie was turned into a good movie about the making of it. The whole thing of this movie has to be given to Tommy Wiseau. Although he's got a great cast of characters with him that he cast, it was his dream that since he wasn't getting roles, and now, I don't want to put Mr. Wiseau down, but when you look at him, he's not your typical Hollywood star. He kind of looks like he could be in some kind of European heavy metal band. He's got an accent that's really nondescript. You can't like look at it and say he's from Russia, he's from Croatia, he's Polish. It's hard to say. And you know, he's definitely got his own acting style, and he makes weird choices as a director. For example, there's a scene where him and his best friend are talking, and the best friend's talking a story about a girl he knew that got beat up by her boyfriend. And for some reason, Tommy decides that a lighthearted chuckle will be the response to this. The Room has lots of these moments and fun little things that audiences have picked up on, whether it's characters walking in and out of rooms, not closing the door, where they yell, you know, close the door, to crazy sex scenes that don't even make any sense. A lot of times, it's like, does he know how people have sex? Because it seems like he might be putting his penis into something that's not what you normally do. It looks like he's got it in her belly button just by the directing and angling of it. It's really stunningly bad. There's subplots introduced that go absolutely nowhere. So for a bad movie fan, it's absolutely the best. To see that it's kind of got a Rocky Horror kind of thing is incredible. Well, recently they showed it at the Playhouse a couple of days ago. I just saw it, and I have to say it was just amazing. And they actually had one of the stars there, Greg Sestero, who travels the country with this movie. Now, he's actually a model. He's a really good-looking guy. And he did a Q&A. He also did an acting class where they did edited, original drafts from the thing that they brought audience members up for. And then he did a little meet and greet where you could sign and pick up stuff. Not only did I get a chance to get pictures with him, as you will see, we will post some of those pictures for you, but I also got finally a chance to pick up one of his follow-up movies called Best Friends, Volume 1 and Volume 2. This is actually him and Tommy Wiseau getting back together, but this time Greg writes the script. And I have heard that it's just as bizarre as The Room, but it's a little more coherent, and it's actually a pretty good movie. So I can't wait to talk about this movie when I see it. But, you know, but anyhow, they had copies there, and I did not even hesitate to buy one of them. They had it on Blu-ray, both of her copies, because apparently this movie is so big it needed to be do two parts, you know, like a Kill Bill or a, you know, Hunger Games, you know, the final, or Twilight or something, or Harry Potter. Anyhow, The Room was great, and this experience was phenomenal. Greg has a great sense of humor about this. Of course, in the Disaster Artist movie, he was played by James Franco's brother, Dave Franco, and of course James played Tommy Wiseau, and it really showed the friendship that they had and still do have, because they're still making movies together. When the Q&A portion came up, I had a chance to ask him a question, and while everybody was concentrating on the room and things in the past, I decided to look to his future and asked what his future projects may include. And he said that him and Tommy would like to attempt a horror movie, which the audience thought was absolutely great. Now, there's rumors that the original script actually has The Room having sort of elements of that, because there are comments that in the original script, Tommy's character was a vampire, and there was something to do with a flying car. I would love to see what that script would be like. But anyhow, The Room is a dramatic romantic film, but it's hard to take serious because the dialogue is so bad, the acting is so bad, just a lot of the choices. But again, it's one of those movies so bad that it's good. Greg was awesome to meet. Very charming, still good looking. He's 41 and he's still very attractive. And I like that because he was very cute. The first time I saw The Room in theaters, I actually dressed up as Mark, his character, where I had a red cutoff shirt, a football, and this wavy blonde hair that he has in the movie and still has. He keeps that coif alive, I'll tell you. But anyhow, he was very generous. He was very open, and he seemed generally sincere that he had come to Hamilton. He had been doing a little bit of a tour of Ontario, and we were so happy to have him. Now, if you get a chance to see one of these showings, and I'm not sure, but the Playhouse makes it sound like they might be doing this again, or monthly showings of this. I could be wrong, but anyhow, what I love about this is that they also kind of, I lost my train of thought. I love when that happens. I suggest that you get a chance to try to find and see The Room in a quiet thing, because there's so much yelling and it's fun. Don't get me wrong, I'm out there yelling too, but you got to hear the dialogue fresh. And if you want to see The Disaster Artist, find yourself a copy of The Room. Now, it used to be on YouTube, but I think you can get some copies out there, but I don't know for sure. But if you get a chance to see it, check it out first when you can. As I said, I got to see it on YouTube with my friends, and I think I watched it 3 times within 2 months because it was so bad and I just dying to show stuff. If you are interested in The Room, you can also go to more plugs, the Damien and Devlin show. Maybe we'll put a link to it because Corda likes to do extra work. You can put a link to it and you can click right after you finish the podcast. Don't you dare leave now. I actually subjected this movie to Damien, who laughed all the way through it, and you can see what he thought of it, me putting him through this movie. A guy who doesn't really get cult films, and I gave him one of the biggest cult movies of all time, so check that out. And yeah, my love for This Room is immense. I can't wait to check out Best Friends, which is the movie him and Tommy did. I hope they work on more stuff together. Again, if you want to see The Disaster Artist, the actual movie, I highly recommend it. It's really good. But if you can, try to watch The Room first, because I think it works better seeing The Room. Like, you could watch The Disaster Artist without seeing The Room and then watch it, but I personally think that seeing this movie first is the way to go, and then watching The Disaster Artist, then going to find a live screening of it, and they are out there. I've heard that a couple friends of mine said that they saw it, where the guys from Riff Tracks, which are basically a couple of the writers from the old Mystery Science Theater show, don't know if they have anything to do with the new show, but Mystery Science Theater 3000, they used to like make little jokes throughout the thing, and they actually did a screening where they did a live, the movie would roll, and then they would come back with their snappy comebacks right away. This movie is out there. You can also get The Disaster Artist book. I've never read it, but I have some friends that say it's absolutely a great read. Even if you're not a fan of reading Hollywood books, it's just a fun read. Some people have called this movie the Citizen Kane of bad movies. It's even been taught in colleges and universities. And if you get the chance, I highly recommend you check out The Room. And if you do make it to a live screening, don't forget to get your plastic spoons with you and look out for that picture, because it will be there. Once you see the room, your life will change forever. I don't know if it's better or not. If you definitely get a chance to see a showing with Greg Sestero live, I highly recommend it. He is so charismatic, and you can tell he embraces being part of this bit of history, and I love that about him. I love anybody who does a movie. Tommy Wiseau himself has kind of said tongue-in-cheek that he knew he was doing a parody of a movie, but everybody in the cast said that no. They did not know. He was trying to make a serious film. Some of the casts include Juliet Dennell, who plays Tommy's girlfriend, Philip Haldeman, and Carolyn Minette are just some of the other people that were in this movie, and they play incredible characters. I haven't even scratched the surface of this movie, you know. Lisa, who is the female lead, basically puts feminism back, like, centuries. I won't even say decades, I'll say centuries. Then you got the character of Denny, who is just supposed to be a teenager, but I noticed is actually a year older than Mark in the movie, but they play him like he's like some college kid. And then Carolyn Minette, who plays Lisa's mother, is probably one of the highlights of the movie. But there are so many characters that suddenly just show up, some that don't have any meaning, subplots that just go nowhere. I can't speak enough of The Room. Hunt it down, look for it. This movie is worth checking out, especially if you love bad films. You need to see this one. Certainly is the granddaddy. Is it the worst film ever made? It's hard to say. I would say it's up there, but because it gives me so much joy, I don't consider this a worse film. I think any movie that entertains me to want to see it, I've seen great films that I've never wanted to see again, you know, but this movie I've seen regular times, so does that make it a bad film? Anyhow, that is my show for today. Thank you for joining me. I hope you had a good time listening to this, and I hope I've educated you on The Room, or if you're a fan of The Room, I hope I made you want to desperately go out and see it again. Anyhow, I will be back trying to be more regular and do these things, because I actually enjoy doing the podcasts, and give me some feedback. Tell me what you like. Do you like my reviews? Do you like my guests? Do you like Topics Teaserama? Do you like when I just talk about my feelings, my emotions? I want to know. And definitely check out past episodes if you haven't seen it. You can also check it out on I don't know what the word is, like iTunes and Google, whatever their podcast site is called. That's not very professional of me. Anyhow, that's my episode, and thank you. I will see you all very, very soon.